The Athletic.
Now here's Bergwijn, only Song to his right. Others are trying to make up the ground now, like Dele Alli and Lucas Moura. Son lines it up. Oh! It's found its way in!
Hello everybody, I'm Danny Kelly and I'm your host for The View from the Lane, The Athletic's Tottenham Hotspur podcast. And this is, after last week's pilot, the first of the new season. You're all very, very welcome. I'll be hosting the show this season and we'll now be bringing you two episodes every week, Monday and Thursday. I'm joined now, the full firm has joined us today, perhaps because of the great result at the weekend. All from The Athletic, of course, Jack Pitbrook. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Danny.
Charlie Eccleshare. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Danny. How are you doing?
Very good indeed. Charlie's broadcasting from an obscure part of The Athletic's offices, which makes him look like he's being chewed by a shark. There's some teeth in front of him there. I think it's a sound baffle. And, of course, James Moore is with us too. Hi, James.
Hi, Danny.
Listen, we'll talk about the game. It was not what I expected. It was fantastic. And we'll talk about the individuals and the collective that made that result happen. But first, I think it's only right to remark upon the ground and the return of the fans to the ground, both of which I thought played a huge part at the weekend. First of all, let me just do the register. Obviously, I live in the Republic of Ireland and have not gone back for the game. James, you're a Spurs fan. I take it you were at the game?
No, I wasn't actually. I was at work. So ironically, given some of the side shows at the weekend, I missed the Spurs game because I was working.
And Charlie, do you? I don't think you were at the game, were you?
I was at the game, yeah.
I was in the
press box, and yeah, it was quite an occasion.
Jack, you were there too, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I was there in a different section of the ground.
What are we to make of it? Because on the television, at least, and you know, we've got big high quality televisions these days. It appeared to me, I'm prepared to say, it was the best day that the stadium has enjoyed. The crowd, perhaps because they hadn't seen each other, meeting people for the first time in over a year, all those sorts of things. Charlie and Jack, tell us about your adventures on the day, because to me it looked like the actual proper unveiling of the stadium.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you say, because of those additional factors, there was a greater heft to it, maybe. I mean, the other two that came to mind, obviously the first City game at the new stadium in the Champions League, the one that Spurs won 1-0. And then the other one that came to mind was the Everton game, which was a few days after Ajax, the 3-2. And Spurs were basically guaranteed top four. And it was just this kind of festival feeling.
That was barely a football match, that one, was it? It was a weird...
It was
2-2, by the way, wasn't it? I think it was 2-2.
Sorry, I was saying 3-2 was the Ajax. I mean, a few days after the 3-2 Ajax game. Yeah, and it was just, that felt like just so breezy and fun. And obviously this had a lot of tension in it because, you know, we didn't know the result was going to be. It was close until the very end. But there just wasn't that same angst and anger that we've seen really at Tottenham for, you know, most of the last couple of years. It's been such a tumultuous time in so many ways. I mean, you know, the last game they played in front of a full stadium, you had Eric Dier going into the stands to confront a fan. Like, that sounds ludicrous saying it now, but that's how toxic it was. The last game they played at home was against Aston Villa, where there were protests before the ground and then after the game. And it was, you know, so there's been so much toxicity. So it did feel like a special occasion. And the piece I wrote off the game was about the kind of redemptive feeling of catharsis that there was yesterday.
Yeah, so I thought the atmosphere was actually very comparable to the 1-0 win against City in the Champions League in April 2019, which I think was what the second game ever played in the stadium. Obviously, having not been to a Premier League game with full fans for so long, you do forget a bit about what it's actually like, but it was really good. You know, it was so loud. I thought, to be honest, I think the fans played a big part in the game as well, because, you know, Tottenham literally didn't touch the ball for the first 15 minutes. And maybe if City had scored, they might have got anxious, but they were, when it became clear after about 25-30 minutes that in fact Tottenham were really causing problems on the break, especially Bergwijn and Lucas, and City were actually looking a bit shaky, the fans were so firmly behind Spurs that I think they gave some extra energy to the team, which helped to get Tottenham over the line in the second half.
I mean, you only have to look, and this is one weekend's experience, but anyone who follows stats as geekishly as I do, the number of away wins in all the major leagues during the shutdown, We're back to normal business again now. Only two away wins, I think, in the Premier League. And one of those was Liverpool at Norwich. So that one was, you know, you could have had that as your banker. The upshot being that the crowds appear to be making a difference again. And take this away from the Spurs podcast into the general world of football. I hope I'm not being too romantic here. I actually think that the Premier League just looked like itself again this weekend because of the presence of you people and everybody else in the grounds. Because as I always say, I mean, let's be honest, these are skilled technicians, professional footballers. But if it wasn't for the crowd, you could watch them playing on Hackney Marshes. That's not the pleasure. It's that interaction between those people and the expectations of the crowd and the joy of the crowd or the anger of the crowd. And I thought it was just fantastic. Nowhere better, really, than at the Lane.
Just quickly, Danny, can I just say something, though? What's interesting about that is that City seem to have this such weird hex about playing at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium that even last season, without fans, and you think they might be insulated from that, they still lost that game 2-0. So it is a weird one. But I definitely agree the fans helped yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, well, Pep Guardiola, he's a pretty intense guy, and so he's exactly the sort of person who'll now be getting some kind of complex about this.
Yeah.
Tottenham have now beaten Pep's teams more than any other team in his career, and that includes Real Madrid. All right, the game itself. I'm going to start this with a piece of darkness. I thought that the lineup, when I saw it, was the weakest Spurs 11, probably since before Pochettino came to the club. For a decade, shall we say that?
But before we do this, was this the lineup we predicted, though? I think it was, wasn't it? I think we all
11,
got
yeah.
that right. Or were we? Oh no, wait! No! Wait! Sorry, I was right. Charlie, you were not right.
How was I wrong?
You said Lo Celso would play instead of Skip.
No, you
said Lo Celso would play instead of Skip.
I said it would be the same 11 that played Arsenal. I said the only one I thought there was a possible doubt over was could Lo Celso play instead of Skip.
So you picked 12 players.
I said I'm going with Skip, but I wouldn't be surprised if Lo Celso played instead.
James, if it makes you feel any better, I definitely said Lo Celso would play.
Yeah,
so
okay.
It was me who got it wrong.
I win.
But
again.
if you think about it, the two centre backs have been dumped by most Spurs fans. The one of the two central midfielders was playing in the Championship last year. Bergwijn and Moura and Ali were all, you know, on the bench last season. I thought it was a very, very weak-looking team. And indeed, that remains the case. But we mustn't do that now. We must just say it was a magnificent victory and a magnificent performance. Those two things are often separate. Just pick out something, each of you, from what you saw that brought you some joy and contributed to Tottenham's victory. Why don't you start, Jack?
So for me, I'd say it was the performance of players who were written off by Mourinho. Throughout the Mourinho era, there was this debate about whether or not the players were actually any good. And obviously, Mourinho's view was that the players, apart from Kane, were useless. And
yeah.
there was only so much he could do because he had no tools to work with. But Bergwijn, I thought, was brilliant yesterday. I thought City could not live with him breaking down the middle. I thought Dele, who again was written off by Mourinho, was probably his best all-round game for Spurs for 2 or 3 years. Playing in the middle, worked so hard on and off the ball. Sanchez, I thought, was fantastic at centre-back. So all these players who we'd been told were no good, in fact, turned out to be pretty good. So from a Spurs perspective, I thought that was positive.
I'm not going to bore people on here. I am going to bore people on this podcast, obviously, but I mean, I'm not going to bore them specifically about Mourinho's baleful influence on everything he touches these days. We'll see what happens at Roma. What did you particularly pick out, James?
I mean, there'll be a bit of overlap here, I guess, on this kind of Venn diagram of positivity.
Totally allowed. Encouraged.
Dele Alli's performance, I think, was, as Jack says, one of his best in the last couple of years. I think I saw a stat somewhere. It was like the most tackles he had made in a game since like his first season with Spurs or something like that. I mean, that the intensity was there, wasn't it? On and off the ball. He was kind of involved in the build-up play, but also like in the pressing and trying to wing the ball back high up the pitch. You know, he wasn't kind of nutmegging people and doing all the flicks and tricks that we kind of fell in love with him for in the first couple of years he was at the club. But he kind of looked like he was enjoying himself a bit more. It looked like he kind of left his mark on the game a bit. And there was, you know, towards the end of the game and it was 1-0 and the clock was ticking down and it was a bit tense. There was a little bit of devilment, as I think Tim Sherwood once called it, with regards to kind of helping kill a bit of time. So yeah, a few of the old Dele Alli hallmarks, I think, back out there. And it was, I think that's a big positive because I think if he can be a big player for Spurs, you know, and we'll have to wait and see what happens with Harry Kane, I think he is a goal scorer and they will definitely need that if Kane goes.
Well, he is the infamous new signing, isn't he? He has done absolutely nothing for 2 years. Now, partly he will admit already to it down to his own attitude, and partly down to the fact that, as Jack pointed out there, the manager thought he was absolutely useless. So having initially butted him up. Charlie, you were in the stadium. What did you notice about Spurs? What do you think contributed to their fantastic win?
Well, right in front of where we sit in the first half anyway was Tanganga against Grealish and Sterling. And Tanganga, literally the second minute, went really strong on Sterling. And it really set the tone. And actually, Tanganga, James will remember, is who I said would start right back. And he then said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I might steal that for when I go first in my lineup.
Let's see what's happened here.
So yeah, it's basically just a way of digging at James. No, I was really, really impressed with him. I thought he genuinely set the tone. You know, you need players who are going to play in that way. We've seen so many times last season, Spurs didn't play with enough intensity. He absolutely did. And he was getting overloaded on his side with Sterling and Grealish. You know, if you look at their touch maps, those two, they're basically both playing as left wingers. So you've got this young guy, Tanganga, against two players that were, you know, big parts of the England squad that just reached the Euro 2020 final on his flank. I thought he was really, really brilliant. But, I mean, it was one of those games where you leave it and, you know, it's like when you go to a great gig or something, there are so many great moments afterwards you want to relive. It was like that. It just so many performances. You're like, wasn't Tanganga amazing? Yeah, he was. Wasn't Lucas Moura amazing? I mean, like, his industry and I know that we get these performances from Moura, and maybe that's why some find him frustrating because he's wildly inconsistent, but also just enjoy the ones when he is great. And the whole of the defence, I mean, yeah, Dyer and Sanchez, who've both been, had a fair amount of criticism. And I thought Ollie Skip really grew into the game as well, like Tanganga, academy graduate. I mean, Skip had a kind of tough opening 5 or 10. I thought, you know,
he looked like he was realising, wow, this isn't Barnsley now, is it? I mean, there's a bit of that going on.
Yeah, but I mean, I gather was very sort of calm. You know, that's what he's like before the game, unfazed by, you know, how big a deal this was. And I thought he then really, he helped with Højbjerg. They won that midfield battle. And I definitely agree with Jack on Bergwijn. I thought he was outstanding. And the thing is, what's interesting is that I went to all the preseason friendlies and they pretty much played this same team. And each time they did this, but each time you're thinking, but it's MK Dons. Okay, but it's Colchester. Okay, it's Chelsea, but they made loads of changes. Okay, then it's Arsenal, but, you know, Arsenal are Arsenal
right
now.
Not much better than MK Dons.
Exactly. So it was really gratifying then to see, though, that actually, no, they were working towards something. And all of the patterns that they did in those games, all of Dele Alli playing in that central midfield role, which he did in those games, it all built towards this moment.
And also the way that Skip played in that deeper role just in front of the defence actually allowed us to see a more adventurous Højbjerg than we saw last season. You know, last season Højbjerg was basically anchored in front of the defence the whole time.
And Højbjerg did that at the Euros for Denmark.
Yeah, whereas yesterday Højbjerg was getting forward and he actually gave Spurs a bit more incision and energy through the middle of the pitch. So I think they did look like a really well-balanced team, and it's credit to Nuno he's able to do that, having only been in the job for a few weeks.
And credit to Nuno then, because the thing that I noticed, and I don't think I've seen a team do this with Manchester City before, the front three, when they had the ball, with the goalkeeper, when Edison had the ball, the front three were completely narrow. They were within the confines of the six-yard box width-wise, and they were just confronting the two centre-backs with a line of three. Inviting, counterintuitively, City to get the ball wide. Most teams want to get the ball wide when they're playing out from the back, partially as a way of averting danger. But in City's case, they want to play through the middle, don't they? They want to get it into that triangle of brilliant players in the midfield first, usually to Gundogan, isn't it? And they just didn't allow them to do that. Now, look, we don't want to get too FIFA badge here, because if you lose the game 2-0, the narrow front three just looks like a gimmick. But if you win the game and you force City to look as turgid in their forward going efforts as Spurs did, I think he might have been onto something there. He certainly just didn't want that first pass to be from Diaz to Fernandinho or whoever was coming to get the ball deep, and they stopped it at source. That
Spurs' tactic of letting Mendy have the ball was quite smart, given how often Mendy just gave it straight away. Obviously, if City had different players, it might have gone differently. But it was very smart tactics from Nuno to make sure they were basically forcing City to play into their own weaknesses.
Yeah, that's known as the Sanchez gambit, isn't it? I mean, that's what those little rondos are about. They're all doing training, isn't it? It's forcing the ball to the least talented ball player. Though I'm not having a go. Davinson Sanchez, I've always believed that there is a proper defender in there if he's allowed to do the things that he's very good at. And we'll see. I mean, the way he plays with Yerry Mina for Colombia, you can see that the contrast in their styles actually suits him. And we'll see if he can keep it up. I mean, you're absolutely right. The individuals, I mean, there was hardly a player who wasn't, you know, 8 out of 10. I didn't notice Sergi Reguilón very much. But given how wild he can be up that wing, I suppose that's a good thing. And overall, the again, this is down to Nuno, I guess, and he's had a little time to work with most of these players. Defensively organised. I mean, I say defensive. They were compact as a team. They looked like there was a... How can I put this properly? Mourinho, of who, of course, is an inspiration to Nuno. Mourinho, we just looked like we're going to end up playing 9 on the edge of the box and hope for the best. This time around, we played 9 on the edge of the box and we seemed to have a plan to develop an attack from there. They looked... I mean, one game in, they looked like a proper, they had a proper plan they were going to stick to it. It'll be different when they play teams who I'd expect to have more possession, won't it?
Yeah, and they didn't stop playing when they were 1-0 up. Like, that was the big problem last year, wasn't it? They'd go 1-0 up and then they'd stop playing, defend their own penalty box. Whereas yesterday, I thought Tottenham continued to have a threat on the break, continued to not just defend in the box when they were 1-0, and that's such a big change.
Well, they probably had the best chance at 1-0, didn't they? That Bergwijn chance is probably the best chance of the game at 1-0.
Yeah, but and they had other breaks as well, but that's such an important point because Spurs lost the second most points from winning positions last season at 23, whereas Nuno, the opposite. Nuno at Wolves is mad. His Wolves team in Premier League games scored almost double the number of second half goals to first half goals. I mean, almost to a fault because their first halves were often unwatchable as a result of that. But he's talked about this already. He talked about the Arsenal game. He talked about it yesterday, how important finishing strongly is. That's something he really prides himself on because he wants his teams to be fitter. And it was a striking difference because they didn't just sit in themselves and kind of invite pressure, as Jack says. And I thought Lucas Moura was really key there. There are a few times where he got it, just drove forward, eased the pressure. That one where he gets the foul from Grealish. I mean, that is just manner from heaven. Is when you're a defender and you're defending your box basically and you've got someone doing that and it just gives everyone a breather, that just makes an enormous difference. But it's mentality as well.
It is mentality, but it takes courage. I mean, so much of sport, football at this particular level, is about doing the courageous thing. And I wonder whether the players had been encouraged to do the courageous thing, as they definitely weren't under Mourinho, where they were terrified of making a mistake. I mean, I think that's the issue with Dele Alli. I think he just got to the point where he didn't know what to do.
Like that Stoke game where he makes the mistake in the Carabao Cup and gets an earful.
These kids are talented when they're 8, 9 years of age. They have 10 years of learning to play the game. They love it. They train with their mates. It's a joy. And then you get told you can't flick the ball on or you can't try and beat a player. Now, you can't do it every time. But Spurs have got themselves to the point where none of the players are trying anything. And Moura, you're absolutely right. Moura's inclination to get the ball down, try and beat the first man. And the way City are set up, if you beat the first man and he doesn't bring you down for one of their famous tactical fouls, you're often straight onto their back players. And we saw the advantage of all of that.
Can I just say one thing on that, or two things? One, Danny, like that is something that people close to this Tottenham team have already noticed, that there is a greater sense of players being allowed to make mistakes. And there was a moment in the Arsenal game, there were a couple of moments actually, where Dele did give the ball away. And this is something that irritates Nuno. You know, he's not someone who likes unnecessary risks, but he kind of allowed it. He wasn't sort of getting at him. And people have detected that this is a change, having a bit more freedom. I also do think we should say that this was a fixture Mourinho won twice. And the first one was a bit of a fluke and the red card changed the game. But I think actually the last one, the 2-0, wasn't too dissimilar from this game. So as you say, and we'll get onto it, it will be really, really interesting seeing how they do against packed defences, because that was something they really struggled with last season.
Yeah, and we can round up this section of the podcast by saying, of course, Manchester City had players coming back. So did Spurs. Things will happen in the transfer window. But let's be fair. If you can beat what Son quite rightly describes as the best team in the world on the opening day of the season in front of your own fans, and of course, it's rather lovely for myself and James on television too, then it really is fantastic. We'll come back in a few seconds' time. Last week, we discussed the mystery of Tanguy and Ndombele. This week, although we could easily do part two of that, by the way, we'll do the mystery of Harry Kane.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. This is what we've got planned for you across the Athletic Podcast Network this season. The Ornstein and Chapman podcast has been rebranded as the Athletic Football Podcast. We'll release four episodes across the week as our journalists bring you the very best insight into the biggest stories in football and the business of sport. Michael Cox will continue to bring you the smartest analysis of all the big games in the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Adam Hurry will now host two episodes of the Football Clichés podcast every single week with his usual take on the game. There's a brand new Athletic FPL podcast with our fantasy football expert, the FPL General, giving you all the advice you need to stay ahead of your mates and top of the FPL rankings. And the Athletic Podcast Network is also home now to a host of club-specific shows, some of which are going to be releasing multiple episodes every week. And we're now your destination, don't forget, for the Totally Football Show with James Richardson and the Totally Football League Show. And that is it. We can't fit any more in. All you've got to do is search for The Athletic in your podcast provider of choice or go to our podcast section on The Athletic app. Not surprisingly, with all of the stuff that I've just mentioned, The Athletic is now the world's biggest football podcast network.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yeah, welcome back to the View from the Lane podcast. I'm Danny Kelly. With me, the full team. Everybody wants to play early in the season. It's good to have them all. Charlie Eccleshare, James Muir, and Jack Pitt-Brook. I'd say last week we were wondering about what the hell has happened to Tanguy Ndombele, who does appear to have completely disappeared. I noticed he's not in the squad for the conference game, the Euro conference game on Thursday. But I'll tell you who is. H. Kane Esquire is in the Euro squad for Thursday, which means that all the television companies, The Athletic, TalkSport and all the rest of them are going to have to send people out to Portugal on the off chance of seeing him. They said he was at the stadium yesterday, but I doubt if Sky's scouts would have not found him. So I doubt if he was there. I don't know if you two, maybe you're sat next to him, Jack. I don't know. What's going on here? What's the latest? I mean, I thought he could never play. He couldn't have played because I think it just causes too much drama in and around the dressing room. And it was noticeable that several of the Spurs players in the run-up to the game and afterwards talked about cutting themselves off from other things. They didn't mention Kane by name. Who's got the inside scoop here, lads? What's happening with this fella?
So Kane only started proper preseason training on Friday after doing his day five test release on Thursday. So having only had 2 days of training, I think Nuno decided that he wasn't ready to play, which I think is probably the right decision. 2 days of preseason isn't very long, and you can't throw a player in for a game like this if he's not ready. I think the bigger question really is why did he only start training that late? Obviously, it's because he was expected back on the 2nd of August and didn't come back on the 2nd of August. And the context for all of this is how much he wants to go to City, which has been the big rumbling story for the last few months. My own view is that he is not going to get his way. Daniel Levy is still absolutely adamant that he'll stay. And so eventually he'll have to get reintegrated into the team, maybe this week or next week. But it's going to, I mean, look, we will keep on talking about this until the end of the window on the 31st of August, I think.
I mean, I was told, over the weekend that the hope is that, because he's not yet reintegrated into full group training, the hope is that he will be this week. And then that makes Thursday and Sunday, either of those, a possibility. You know, it's one of those we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, I mean, Jack touches on it. I don't think anyone is questioning that 2 days is not long enough. But, you know, obviously the big question is, you know, why was he only left with 2 days? Because we knew that wasn't going to be enough. And I think the optics of it are made worse because there were lots of other England players playing over the weekend. In fact, pretty much everyone was there. So it will be very interesting because once he plays, you know, that slightly changes how it looks. But I've been asked this so many times, will he stay? But same as Jack, I mean, we keep being told, our information is that Spurs aren't budging. So it does, you know, just comes down, are City going to put in a mega bid that makes it irresponsible to say no?
Yeah, and the selections will be very interesting, because if Spurs have it in their minds that they will let him go if they get, as you say, a mega bid for him, then they probably, you wouldn't play him, would you? I mean, you probably shouldn't play in Portugal anyway. But for the simple reason, if you are expecting to get a huge offer for your vintage car that you've got out the front of your house, you don't take it out for a drive in case somebody gives you a swipe. And he is accident prone, isn't he, on a football pitch? Let's be honest. I have to say, this is purely emotional. I want him to stay, but the sight of Spurs lining up people like Lautaro Martinez for 60 and 70 million does suggest that either they have sold the naming rights to the stadium and not told us, or that Joe Lewis has suddenly woken up from a long, long, long sleep that he's been having on his yacht and decided he better put some money into this football club before it becomes valueless. Or, of course, they're already spending the money in advance.
Well, or it's somewhere in between, which I think is the reality, is that it's, you know, it's a slight due diligence thing, isn't it? I think everyone would be getting on Spurs' back. They were saying, how can you not even be considering the possibility of, you know, that would be borderline irresponsible of Paratici. So I think it's, you know, it's somewhere there. Well, what's key as well, and I'm not 100% sure of this, if he were to play on Thursday, would that cup time for the Champions League?
If only the complexities of the new European tournaments, where you can parachute in and out of them, were as clear cut as that.
Because surely that's then a huge decision. I'm not sure that is the case. I think players have been able to play in one and then the other.
Yeah, I think you're okay going upwards, aren't you?
Well, I think they changed the rules. I think in around 2018, they changed it so you could play in one and then the other, but you couldn't play in the same one. So I think he may still be all right.
It does seem a bit bonkers that you can't play in one in two separate, completely separate tournaments. Although the point that James makes that they're not separate tournaments, because they're umbilically, people have forever been parachuted snakes and ladders style in and out of these blinking tournaments. So the point where the thing that I'm most looking forward to this season, the final of the conference between Spurs and Mourinho's Roma, may not even happen. But I think the UEFA should do their best to rig the draw to make sure. No, I know that would never, ever happen. Hello, first day of the season, Manchester City, Harry Kane, etc. Well, one thing to come out of all of this, of course, the Spurs fans were joyfully celebrating one of their own in Japhet Tanganga and teasing Harry Kane about him being watching. But actually, Manchester City's need for a striker, Jack, was probably thrown into pretty sharp focus by the performance yesterday. Will this liven them up, do you think, in this chase of Harry Kane?
That's a great question. I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this. Like, the fact is, City won the league last season without a striker. You know, they had Kevin De Bruyne up front all season. They won the league and they got to the final of the Champions League. Clearly, Guardiola really likes Kane. And, you know, you can easily argue that City need Kane. Whether or not City want Kane so much that they will pay enough money to really give Daniel Levy something to think about, that's been the big question all summer. And we still don't know the answer to it. And I think the closer we get to 31st of August without City paying that money would suggest to me that maybe City are a bit ambivalent about Kane. Maybe they don't want to go all the way up to 150 plus million. So while I do understand the logic of what you're saying, I still don't think it's going to make City break the bank this week.
The problem, I think, for both Harry Kane and his efforts to get to Manchester City, and let's say Kylian Mbappe, who is now, with the arrival of Messi, making noises about wanting to go to Real Madrid, is that in 11 months' time, Erling Haaland will be available for half what you'd have to pay for either of these two players. And anybody who saw Haaland's performance against Frankfurt at the weekend, where he scored two, made three, and might have had nine, he was monstrous. I think the German word, Charlie, is Ungeheuer, a monster. it was just incredible. And of course, the market is still awash with relatively bargain strikers if Manchester City were scouting properly. I noticed that Eric Lamella came on for Seville at the weekend and scored two excellent goals to give them all 3 points on the first day of the La Liga season. Well done, Eric. I love
Eric. Did Lamella ever score a league brace for Spurs?
No,
surely not. He only scored about 17 goals.
Yeah,
he scored 8 Rabonas, 4 tap-ins, and that was it, wasn't it?
Danny, on that, just the way you were going with that, because Jack and I wrote a piece kind of arguing the for and against of whether...
I read it, yeah.
Yeah, well, where do you stand on that? Because it sounds like you're maybe thinking, you know, would you accept 150 million for Kane?
Given that I don't think that's enough for him, personally, No, I wouldn't. I don't run Spurs as a business, and I don't think about them as a business. I think about them as a football team. You do not sell your best players.
So there's no amount of money that could tempt you.
I suppose if it got up to 200 million, and a couple of years ago on my show on TalkSport, we were doing how much is Harry Kane worth. This was just after he'd signed his contract and was getting 30 goals a season. And I remember a Manchester United fan came on because I was saying he's worth £250 million. He came on and said that I was insane. And not only did I ban him from the show, I have that power, but I also said, right, as a result of that, it's now £300 million to Manchester United. And I feel the same way now. Against all the things I promised myself a few years ago, I'm entirely attached emotionally to the fella. And I would, frankly, I'd sell all the 24 of the rest of the squad before I'd sell him. But Daniel Levy is not, at least on the surface, as emotionally attached to the football team as I am. And I suspect there is a price for him. And, you know, people are smarter about the game than me will come back and say, but you could, you know, shore up this part of the team, buy that part of the team. We had all this with Gareth Bale. Some players are irreplaceable. Things we're going to do on this podcast, I'm delighted to say, is to ask our listeners, an ever-growing army, I'm delighted to report as well, fantastic numbers last week. We're going to build on that until we crush all other podcasts beneath our wheels. If your friends are running other Spurs podcasts, warn them now, get out while their children can still afford to eat and go to school, okay? Because that's what we're going to do. We're going to get some questions on. Indeed, next Thursday's one, we'll concentrate. Otherwise, we've got a choice here. We can either do a whole lot of Q&As, interesting Q&As and ideas from our listeners, or we can genuinely try and preview a game against a team that even I know very little about. And trust me, I keep a very, very beady eye on things like the Portuguese League. So why don't we get some questions that we got earlier on from these are all subscribers to The Athletic. So the first question then, which was addressed to Charlie personally, but it could be answered by anybody, and it was from Jacob F. And Jacob says, what does Bergwijn need to focus on to get more goals? Because always, when you just use the player's surname, it always means you've got a slight suspicion about them, doesn't it? what does Bergwijn need to do to focus on to get more goals? He looked fantastic today across all areas, dribbling, passing, shooting, tackling, runs off the ball, etc. But not enough to convert him into goals, while his assist felt kind of fluky. What should he double down on? I mean, it was a good performance by Steven Bergwijn, who has another one who's had under Mourinho a wasted season. But that finishing thing is an issue, isn't it?
It is, but I think so much of this with Bergwijn, last year it looked like confidence was the big thing. You think back to that. And I did have flashback to his miss at Anfield where he hit the post, which would have put Spurs ahead, and then they lost. And then since then, you know, basically the season, that last season went to shit. And I did fear that might happen again yesterday. But yeah, the big thing's confidence and also sharpness. I mean, he looks so much fitter. He's worked really, really hard in pre-season. He didn't go on holiday. He went home and just kind of focused on getting as fit and ready as he could possibly do. He's another one who missed the Euros, so that benefited him. You know, obviously, I'm sure he was gutted, but more benefited Spurs anyway. So I don't know. I mean, we talk about what to focus on. I think if he keeps making these runs, you know, keeps getting into these positions, I do think the goals will come because he can score goals brilliantly. You know, you think back, obviously, the one against City on his debut, the one against Villa last season, which was his only Premier League goal or goal in any competition last season. So I do think it is just about continuing to make sure he's as sharp as possible, keep getting in the right positions. He scored one against Chelsea in the preseason friendly. And, you know, that just came from taking a shot on where, I think last season he might have checked, it was on his left foot as well, he might have checked back and looked for a pass. There are people who think he needs to be a bit more selfish. You know, he often will look for the pass. There was one in pre-season at Colchester where he was through and squared it for Son and Son scored. So it was the right thing to do. But yeah, I think there are some people who think, yeah, you know, just back yourself. No one's going to like you running at them with that pace. So yeah, just believe in yourself.
I mean, this is rich coming from a person as superbly upholstered as myself, but I'm obsessed with the changing shape of footballers. When I was your age, they all looked like middle-aged middleweight boxers. Now they all look, of course, like middle distance runners. More so than ever. I mean, Dele Alli hasn't got a pick on him, I noticed. And Bergwijn too, James, Jack, I mean, I'm not developing myopia here, am I? He looked to me to have dropped, as they say in the trade, a few kilograms, and it suited him. His strength and muscularity was still there, but he was much quicker over the ground, I thought. He looked that way anyway.
Yeah, he was really quick. And I think his those runs down the middle of the pitch he was able to make on the counter-attack, City had no answer to it. Usually Fernandinho is so good in that area at just, you know, fouling, repeatedly fouling an opponent, but never ever getting booked.
The so-called Tanganga method, yeah.
That's his magic power. And yet yesterday, he simply couldn't keep up with Bergwijn. And to be honest, I love watching Bergwijn because he's so direct, and he doesn't, you know, waste his time thinking about things. He gets forward, he takes opponents on, he tries to call, you know, he causes questions for opposition defenders. And so it was really good to see him playing with a bit of confidence again, which we haven't really seen ever under him consistently.
And aside from that, I mean, when Spurs haven't got the ball, when he's trying to get it back, which wasn't really a thing, as we were saying before, that happened too much under Mourinho, you know, attacking players trying to win the ball back high up the pitch. Like, if he's got a little bit more in the tank, he's going to be in a better position to do that.
Even that thing of the forwards defending... I know I'm obsessed with how badly Mourinho did at Spurs, and not say he's a bad manager, but he did very badly there. Even then, the forward players going back to defend, they weren't running in what I thought were logical places. Bergwijn used plenty of energy going backwards, and making sure he got into his place, but he could see he was getting into the place where he was supposed to be, the very place that allowed the fullback, whichever one he was covering, because it changed at various times in the game, to take up the kind of position that Tanganga was allowed to position. Because, you know, the City's threat down the left-hand side, on paper at least, is so frightening. And yet, just get yourself into a good position, do it with enthusiasm. It goes a long way, and I thought he did a lot of that as well. Let me get it. Move on.
Well, that was something that... Sorry, one of our other listeners, Colm E., wrote in, and what Colm was getting at was... Does he almost do too much defensive work, Bergwijn? You know, does he need to have more of an end product, or and do we sort of forgive him that because he works so hard defensively? And I do sort of see that, but I also think when he plays like he did yesterday, where he's helping out defensively but also carrying a real goal threat, then I just think that's fantastic. And yeah, I'm fairly confident that the goals and you know, he got the assist yesterday. That they'll come.
Listen, that was just one or two questions there brought to us by the listeners and subscribers. That's the correct word, I think it is, to The Athletic. Listen, we do need your questions for next Thursday. Otherwise, as I say, otherwise you'll be put through the penitential purgatory of us trying to talk about a game in Portugal that none of us are truthfully knowledgeable about, that we will gen up if we have to. Look, we're all there on Twitter. Get your questions in to Jack and James, to Charlie and myself. The Twitter is all available to you there. Also, The Athletic has any number of ways of getting in touch with us. Get your questions in about anything to do with Spurs, individuals, the team, the club, Harry Kane, all the rest of it. And we'll do our best to answer them next Thursday in the next edition of the From the Lane podcast, which only reminds me to make sure that you people are actually doing some other work other than just coming on here and having a laugh. Charlie, what have you been writing about with regards to the mighty Tottenham Hotspur?
Yeah, well, I've mentioned a couple of them. Jack and I did a piece debating with one another about whether selling Kane, whether there is an amount at which it does make sense. And I was saying that I think that there does come a point at which you say, you don't want to have this circus every transfer window and you think about moving on. I mentioned last week as well, I don't think it came out by that point, did a big read on Nuno. And, you know, he's a guy who I think the fans have really warmed to. You know, I thought it was heartening. You know, he was getting really, really positive reception yesterday before the game. Then afterwards, he was high-fiving. So it's a real deep dive into his methods, kind of framed against Mourinho. Obviously, the two of them worked together at Porto. Mourinho was his manager, and Nuno is a former Porto manager himself, and lots of similarities, but also a lot of differences. And then the piece I wrote off the game yesterday was basically, which I touched upon earlier, just after 2 years of shit, basically, how redemptive this felt. And just making the point as well, like, I said this to James yesterday, that there's always an issue with writing off the first game of the season or even the second or third, because you're naturally going to be accused of, it's one game. Why, you know, get, you know, calm down. We're not going to win the league. It wasn't that bad. It wasn't that good. We're not going to get relegated. And the point was, I'm not saying that this game means Spurs are going to have a great season or a good season or even a mediocre season. Yesterday, it didn't really matter. It was just about those 90 minutes. It was
spot on.
That's all it was. Lucas Moura next week might be running down blind alleys. We might be raging at him. We might be saying Spurs can't defend. Didn't matter. Yesterday was just about a standalone occasion, and it felt amazing after those 2 years.
And to, what have you been adding to the gaiety of the nation with, Jack?
Just written a piece about Harry Kane's situation, asking why, if all the other England players were available to play this weekend, 5 weeks on from the end of the Euros, why the England captain was, along with Jordan Henderson, we should say, he's also not fully fit, why was Kane not available to play for Tottenham? We all know the reason why, but I think it's fair to ask the question, particularly given that Kane has been, you know, commendably quick to come back from injuries in the past to play for big games. You know, 2019 Champions League final, 2021 Carabao Cup final. If Kane wants to play, he makes himself available to play. Like, that's very much been the story of the last 2 years at Tottenham. And yet this weekend he was nowhere to be seen. So I thought that is a relevant issue. And I think really for the next week or so, Charlie and I will be doing a lot of focusing on the end of the transfer window for Tottenham, seeing who else Paratici can bring in, probably another forward, maybe another defender as well, if they can find the money. As Spurs try to wrap up what has, I think, so far actually been a pretty good window in the circumstances.
Well, in regards to Harry Kane's unavailability, compare and contrast young Pedri, who between Barcelona, the Euros and the Olympic Games at the weekend made his 72nd appearance of the calendar year. Sports scientists will not approve, but he's such a brilliant player. I like to see him play. Listen, chaps, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you very much, James Moore, Jack Pitt-Brook, and, of course, Charlie Eccleshare. We'll all be back Thursday answering some of your questions and doing a little bit of preview, at least, of the weekend's game against Wolves. And if you're not already a subscriber, you can read all those fantastic articles we've been talking about by going to theathletic.com/SpursPod. And right now, you can sign up with a 33% discount on a full subscription. We'll be back on Thursday. Don't miss it. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.